Great, thanks for the introduction. Sorry for the brief delay. Welcome to Usenix Tech Sessions. Thanks very much for being here, and thanks for the invitation. I'm looking forward to it. I've worked on servers for most of my life. In fact, talking about Jerry Popick reminds me of 15 plus years ago, I ran one of Jerry's operating systems when I was working at IBM. And 5 years ago, I was lucky enough to work with Jerry as an expert witness on a security, on a big lawsuit we were involved with. And so I feel real fortunate to have met him. He's contributed a huge amount, and I'm very happy to be here to talk to you all today. What I'm going to talk about is the evolution of my thinking around servers. When I first started working with one of his operating systems, I believed that single server OSs was interesting, and that was the future, and I was running big RISC systems and having a lot of fun and thinking that was the future. I became convinced that clusters were the future, and where I am today, and I've been for the last 5 years, is the entire data center is the computer. And what I'm going to talk about today is I'm going to try to catch your interest in the same way it's caught mine on what happens in a modern data center, where some of the optimization possibilities are, and why this is both important to society and also arguably fairly easy work. There's a lot we can do here. And so that's the plan of attack. Do me a favor, could you drop the volume just slightly? What I'm going to cover today is I'm going to start off with an introduction to the problem at hand. And that is to say, I'm going to try to convince you that very high-scale services, and by that I mean tens of thousands of servers, are really very different than most enterprise deployments. And I'm going to talk about why they're different. And the reason that's important, there's two reasons. One is it tells us that a lot of what we read about these services, in fact, aren't completely true. So I'll draw some of those distinctions. Second reason it's important is I believe it is the future. I believe enterprise deployments are heading in this direction, so if we understand these systems, we're going to understand where the world's going overall. I like to look at where the costs are, because the costs tell me where research is interesting. I hate doing work where people say, that's nice, like, just, you know, nice little finding. I want work that gets picked up and used. And so what I've done and what I've always done is I go looking where the money is. Because where the money is where the problems are, and where the problems are is where the most fun is. And so I'll look at where's the money go in big data centers, and then we'll talk about power and where the power goes. Specifically, I'll track power from the property line to a very large data center at 115,000 volts all the way down to 1.2 volts DC to deliver to the semiconductor. Then we'll track the heat that's dissipated at the semiconductor level all the way back to the outside of the building. And what we're looking for throughout both those trips is where are the inefficiencies and what can we do differently and how can we improve them. Finally, I'll look at server and application efficiencies, and the prime goal there is to try to convince any of you that aren't already convinced that the performance is a stupid measure of servers. It's not an interesting measure. Never is a single dimensional number the right answer. What we ought to be looking at is engineering numbers. That's work done per joule and work done per dollar. So I'm going to keep pushing on those as being the right metrics. And my claim is if you use those metrics to drive your work, you will get a different answer than most server purchases today, and you will get a different answer than most service designs today. So it's worth looking at. Finally, I'll touch on resource consumption shaping, just because it is, in my view, it's one of these ideas that you can keep applying and applying and applying and applying, and there's just big opportunities there. And again, I hope to catch your interest. My background and biases, I've spent about 15 plus years in the database world. I was lead architect on IBM's DB2. I spent a decade at IBM, spent 12 years at Microsoft. I've led most of the teams inside SQL Server. I've spent the last 5 years working in services, and I told you why. It's because there's big opportunities to make things a lot different there. How much different? Well, 20 years ago when I first started working in database, one release, we improved DB2 by a factor of 10x better, measured using TPC A and B. And the only way you could ever improve anything by 10x is start low. You have to have problems. And in the database world, if you can get 5 or 10% improvement today, you're a god. You're really amazing. It's very, very difficult. These systems are getting good. Well, in the services world, we're back 20 years ago. There's those 10x opportunities here, and I'll show you 4 or 5. By the way, only part that's important here is this work doesn't necessarily represent the work of Amazon or the work of Microsoft. Both companies can be sensitive, and we need to respect that. What I'm talking about is how the industry works and how large data centers work, not how specific companies' data centers work. Okay, the first thing was important is a lot of what you hear about what a high-scale service looks like comes from analysts like IDC and Gartner and other folks like that. And the reason is they have experience with enterprises. Enterprises have huge multi-thousand node deployments, and so it looks like it must be the same, and that's what we tend to hear about. But it's completely different. Completely different. In the enterprise, you have an incredibly complicated world where you'll have multiple versions of Oracle, perhaps a copy of SQL Server, you'll have a copy of PeopleSoft, maybe SAP came with an acquisition. It's a complicated world. And so it's more people intensive. And what makes it even harder is there's usually only a small number of copies of each service. And so as a consequence, you can't afford to invest an entire team in automation. So if you talk to someone from the enterprise world and say, what drives your cost? It's people. And everything you hear about what drives cost in the service world is people. And it is correct for the enterprise, but it's not correct for the service world. In the service world, where we have thousands and thousands and thousands of exactly identical images, we manage images, we manage roles, server roles, rather than individual servers. And so the administrative costs are fundamentally different. Where in the enterprise world, you could get 100 servers, usually ends up costing another administrator, maybe 140. In the services world, I've seen it as high as 2,000. So very, very different number. The implications of this are pretty serious. In this enterprise world, people cost dominate, and so I'm very motivated to try to find ways to reduce people costs. I'm willing to buy scale-up servers to reduce people costs. I'm willing to spend more on hardware to reduce people costs. That's sensible. In the service world, people cost isn't in the top 4 or 5 costs. I ran a not a particularly efficient service. It was a $27 million a year company. It wasn't that efficient. And it was 9% operational people costs. If you take all of the ops, all of customer support, all of the servers, all the data centers, all the networking costs, add it all together, people costs are 9%. On very high scale services, I've seen them down below 3. These are hard numbers to achieve. But the moment you get down below 9 or 10, it's not in your top 5. It's just not the most interesting focus. And so, ironically, in the services world, we're actually willing to trade off people in order to reduce our hardware costs because they dominate. And in fact, that's the right thing to do again. So very different worlds. Why would you care? I'm sure Yahoo, IBM, Microsoft, Google, Baidu, they run very high scale, tens of thousands of node services. Why would you care? Because not everyone's going to work there. I'm arguing, and I believe this to be the case, that is the model for the future. We're going to see everyone heading that way because it's a factor of 10 more efficient, and so it's going to happen. So this is a hint to the future, and that's why it's important to us. Second thing is, because it's different, it teaches us better look closer at cost to make sure that what we're reading is accurate, because you don't want to be working on the wrong problem. So let's do that. What I'm doing here is I've taken a 15 megawatt critical load facility. I chose 15 megawatts because Microsoft doesn't have one and Amazon doesn't have one. It's not a size that's in use by other companies, so there's no confusion that this is, oh, you're talking about X. I'm not. It's a 15 megawatt critical load facility. What that means is the servers get delivered 15 megawatts to them, which is to say, on an average facility, it'll probably be getting total power, the actual power including power distribution losses and cooling, probably will run around 21, 22 megawatts. So it's a big facility, by no means the biggest, not even close to the biggest, but it's a good sized facility. So that's why I chose it. About $200 million to produce this. We fill it with servers at about 2K each, which is less expensive than most are using, a little bit more expensive than some, average number. We amortize them over a 3-year period. The game that I play here is in order to understand costs, when I've got some costs, like power, that are that you pay as you consume it, and I've got some costs, like servers, that you pay over that you pay and then you use them for 3 years, sometimes four, sometimes five, and I've got some costs, like infrastructure, when you're buying a 115,000-volt transformer, that's going to last 15 years. And so we've got these different amortization periods. It's impossible to compare data from across the board in an equal way. And I really want to compare in an equal way because I want to be able to trade off different types of costs. So what I've done is I've taken the monthly charges, and I'm paying those monthly, and I've taken three-year amortization periods. I've paid for the cost of money during that period, and I'm saying, what would it cost to effectively rent money for that period? And so we've got the amortization periods and the infrastructure at 15 years, some use 10, and I've got the infrastructure, the server amortization period set at 3, some use 5, but you can adjust the numbers as you will. What falls from this is what's shown down below. This is interesting for a couple reasons. If you, again, if you look at the headlines, this is another debunking slide. If you listen to the headlines, what's the biggest cost of data center today? It's power. Power is the biggest problem in data center. Power dominates everything. We're consuming over 3% of North Americans' power. Power is in every headline, and so let's go look. We dig through the data, and we look at that, and we say that big blue slice must be power. And it's not. In fact, the green slice is power. The green slice that's under a quarter of over of all the costs in the system, that's power. And what that says is everything you're hearing is wrong. Power is absolutely not the dominant cost in the data center. And that's kind of surprising because everyone's talking about power. And this is one of those ironic things where people are dead wrong, but what they're talking about actually is leading us in the right direction. So I'm not actually against it, but it's worth understanding why it's wrong because it helps us think more clearly and solve problems more effectively. So it is wrong because server costs dominate. Number one is absolutely server costs. But if you dig a little deeper, you get a little bit more interesting data out of that. The first one is, if you look at the, if you look at power, in order to dissipate power, in order to consume power, you have to have the distribution gear in the data center. You have to have all the stacks of transformers and UPSs and switch gears and conductors that bring power to the server. So arguably, not arguably, definitely, power distribution is functionally related to power. Okay. Second observation, laws of thermodynamics being what they are, if you dissipate a watt in the data center, you better get it out of there. Which is to say that cooling, mechanical systems, are functionally related to power. So this is interesting. That says that the red slice of that chart is actually functionally related to the green slice. So I put them together, power, power distribution, and cooling, and I call it fully burdened power. The only way you can use power in a data center is to pay the whole bill. So we might as well look at it all together. Now, if you do that, it's almost a dominant slice. So now we're getting to the point where the headline's nearly correct. Still not quite, but getting there. What takes the final step is an observation of the near future, and that is the cost of computing continues to fall. It's not on a Moore's Law pace because there's disk drives in there and memory subsystems aren't improving at quite Moore's Law. There's a bunch of other factors, but there's no debate. It is improving. So server costs are falling. Infrastructure costs, 13,000-volt transformers from ABB or Siemens, are actually flat to increasing. Power is flat to increasing. So what we've got is the red and the green are flat to increasing. The server costs are going down. And so in the end, if you look at functionally related to power, it does dominate. It is the thing we should be optimizing for. And everything we should do should focus on that problem. But I still think it's worth understanding why that's true, because it's not just power. And there's a whole bunch of interesting things that follow from this chart that you wouldn't get otherwise. Let me give you one just because it's I love arguing with the industry. So here's one. People say you should pack all your workloads on the smallest number of servers possible and shut the rest of the servers off because that'll save you the dominant cost, power. But you look at the chart and you say, well, that's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. What it's true and you do get from this is, wait a second. If I could sell the resources of an idle server for more than the marginal cost of the power, which is tiny, it's one quarter of the cost of the system, if I could rent that server or somehow use it for something useful that's worth more, than that tiny green slice, then it's a win. So that says, don't shut them off, use them. Rule one, use them. Rule two, shut them off. It is the right answer if you can't find a way to use them, but try, because it's such a small slice. If we take this data center and we put it in the desert, or we put it beside a nuclear power plant where power is 3 cents or 3.3 or 3.4 cents per kilowatt, that reduces that slice to an eighth. At that point, it says if you can do anything of any use, it's worth doing. Power usage effectiveness, interesting metric. The design of this metric is to help us understand how efficient a data center is. When you've got a workload running on top of servers, it's very complicated. It's hard to understand how efficient is the data center, because it's all blended together with the service itself. And so what's looked at here is, if we look at the power that's delivered to the property line, that's what the utility is actually charging. And we say, okay, that's total power. And we look at the power that's delivered to the servers inside the data center. That's called the critical load. That's the work that's actually potentially doing work. We know it's only potentially because some of the servers aren't being fully utilized. We know that it's only potentially because some of the servers are running very inefficient code. But be that as it may, it's at very best, at least power getting to the server might do something useful. So it's power to the server compared with the total power. So we take total power, divide by power delivered to the server, and it tells us how efficient the data center is. 1.7 is a real typical number. Not a typical number, I shouldn't say that. It's a good number. In fact, the numbers can run as bad as 3, and they can be as good as 1.2, 1.3 for an amazing data center. What do these numbers mean? Well, take a 1.7 number. That's what you would get if you went to a consultant and said, build me using the state of the art, no innovation, no breakthrough, just a good solid design. And that's what I'm going to use as an example today. You would be better than the vast majority of the world, and you'd be around a PUE of about 1.6, 1.7. What does that mean? That says every watt that gets delivered to the server, we're going to dissipate about 0.6 watts in power distribution losses and in cooling costs. Okay, so that tells us, invert that number, that tells you about 59% of the power is doing useful stuff for you, potentially. So useful metric helps understand and compare data centers. The problem with it is anytime a metric's interesting and useful, people cheat. This is another one of those cases. And so if I start measuring the power at 480 volts instead of 13,000 or 115,000, I avoid some conversions that I don't get to charge to my infrastructure. So it looks better. That's unfortunate. It means it's harder to compare these numbers. On the other side, folks like myself are trying to blur the line between the server and the data center, because there's interesting optimizations if you stop looking at a server as a server and you start to move some of the parts around. And if you move some of the parts around, what's critical load, if it's in the server, it's called critical load, and we think of it as you doing useful work. If we move it out of the server, then the same fan suddenly is becoming infrastructure, and I just made my PUE number get worse. So it causes us to do the wrong thing, because those little tiny 1U fans are about the most inefficient thing there is on the planet. It's a terrible design, and yet if you keep them in the server, the infrastructure looks better. So we don't want a metric that does that. Let me give you a data point on what terrible means. I recently instrumented a very large manufacturer's server. I measured the fan power in this poor system, in my personal view. 60 watts of fan power in a 400-watt server. When I say a 400-watt server, you already know there's something wrong with it. It's a little bit high, a little bit in the high side. 60 watts of fan power. Terrible story. Terrible story. And so we want to optimize that fan power. So I'm proposing a metric called TPUE, and that measures from mid-voltage, 13,000, all the way down to semiconductor. All the conversions get charged to infrastructure. All the air motion, fan, cooling, everything gets charged to infrastructure. I think it's a way better metric, and I'm urging you all, consider using it and consider asking vendors to use it. TPUE, if you want a long, excessively long, perhaps, paper on why I think it's a good idea, search for my name and TPUE, and help me out with this one if you can. I really want the industry starting to rally around this number. Okay, we've defined PUE, And the advantage of PUE is it's super easy to measure. We know the power coming into the facility, and we know the power we're delivering to the servers, and so it's an easy number to get. As soon as we get that number, we start to crack the nut. Because I've got that number, I know the servers are getting 59% of the power I'm paying for. So that says, great, I'm paying 41% for other stuff. So now we can dig and find out what the other stuff is and make sure we like it, because we might be able to save some money. It's a good thing. So cooling, I'll show you in detail, is a very, very, very complex analog system full of pumps and fans and way too many energy conversions. Trying to figure out how efficient the cooling system is incredibly hard. And I wrestled with this for a long time, coming up with numbers that were completely non-credible, before I realized there's a better way. And that is, the power system we can understand in incredible detail. And I can get a very precise number on the power system. So if it's not power, then it's cooling. And so if we get the 8%, subtract off the rest, that is cooling. Now we've got a super interesting number. There's three bits of data that I get out of this chart. The first piece of data is working on server utilization, server efficiency, or server cost is a great thing. No question. Second thing I get out of this is working on power distribution optimization. Nothing wrong with it. In fact, I am working on it. But don't focus too much on it because it's just not a big problem. And the third one is, how can we possibly be paying one-third of all the power that goes into a facility just to get rid of all the power that gets delivered to the facility? It just doesn't feel right. And any time an engineer sees something that doesn't feel right, probably opportunity. And this one's like that. So that's what I get out of these numbers so far. Let me show you the power distribution number. I told you 8%. Let me show you how it actually works. Here's a model, a diagram, of how power gets distributed in a very large data center. This is my standard 15-megawatt facility, and I'll keep using it throughout the entire talk. This 15-megawatt facility gets delivered 115,000 volts from the utility in the top left-hand corner. From there, we step it down to mid-voltage. In North America, that's 13,200. In Europe, it's around 13,000, 15,000. These numbers vary slightly, and so it's oftentimes what you'll hear is the 115K referred to as high voltage, the 13K referred to as mid-voltage, and the 480 volts referred to as low voltage, relatively low. It's actually reasonably high. Okay, so that's rough numbers. The thing you'll see different between Europe and North America is things like the 480 is 400 in Europe, but everything plays out the same, and it's basically identical, and a great many of the parts will actually capable of doing either. And so some of the transformers that get sold in one market get sold in the other market. They're just tapped out at different points in the windings. Okay. So let's look at the efficiency. The first level of transformation is incredibly efficient, 97.7, amazingly efficient. The reason for it is there's not many of those. You can spend a lot on them. It's amortized over a huge number of servers, and so buying extraordinarily good transformation is pretty common. We're passing it through an uninterruptible power supply at 13,000 volts. This particular supply takes all the voltage, rectifies it to DC, and then inverts it back to AC, which is not very efficient. We gave up 6% in there, running them at 94%. We gave up a lot on that one. There are alternative designs, bypass UPSs, where the power mostly goes around it, doesn't go through two levels of conversion. The problem with those is automatic switch gear sometimes doesn't automatically switch. It makes people nervous. And so this design's still a little bit more common today. If you went with a bypass type design, it'd be about 97% efficient. Then we go through another level of transformation down to 480. Then we get down to 208. 208 gets delivered to the servers. So that's all of the conversions. There's a couple flaws in this design you could criticize. One is the only way to get this level of efficiency in the lower level transformations is by not having isolation. Which is to say, harmonics from the power supplies could cause this design to fail. If you went with an isolated design, it would be somewhat less efficient. So we could give up another 3 or 4% on that. So the 8% number could grow to 12. The other thing about this design, it's slightly more efficient because we're running the UPS at mid voltage rather than low. Almost everyone runs it at low. Turns out it's slightly more efficient at mid, but it's not. That's mostly you can ignore that. So take this number. It says 8% with a better design might be as high as 12%, but that's roughly the losses that we're getting on the power distribution side. Here's a trick I like. I'm going to intersperse little tricks that I like. This is a wonderful one. The way power gets distributed in a data center is the dumb way that almost nobody uses is you take a server, you look in the back and say, what's the label, how many amps does it draw, and you use that to guide how many servers you put in the data center. The problem with that is a label on the back is like a TPCC benchmark. It's a number that will never be hit. And so if you use that, half the power in the data center won't get used. So few people use that. There are some, but few. Next smart one is put the server at full load, clamp the power line, find out what the draw actually is. That's actually a pretty good approach, and that's what most folks do. If you use that, there's still reasons why the power is going to be, you're going to leave a lot of power on the table. And the reason for it is, what are the odds that you're going to get tens of thousands of servers all peaking at the same time and all drawing the maximum they can possibly draw? Well, the answer is, depends a little bit on the deployment. But if there's any heterogeneity in what you're, in the workloads you're running, it's very unlikely they'll all peak at the same time. And the big secret of the industry is 30 or 40% utilization, you'd be a hero. 10% utilization, some enterprises don't even do that well. And so at that low level of utilization, you're so far off the peak that you're leaving a lot of power on the table. So some wonderful work done by Luis Barroso, Wolf Weber, and Pham said, what if we treated this like an airline? What an airline does is they sell more seats than they have. And they run risks that all the folks won't show up. And you need to have a safety net. You need to be able to offer someone a free ticket to Hawaii or something like that that you very rarely use, and the same thing applies here. You need a safety net, because if you overdraw the facility, you'll either pop a breaker, in which case the whole portion of the data center goes down, very expensive, or you'll sag the utility, and they will make that expensive for you in a hurry as well. So neither one of those is a good thing, and because that's such a scary outcome, no one wants to push this. It takes a lot of care, and the safety net is to be able to shed load. You want to be able to shed load. If you get unlucky and a black swan event hits and every service in the data center all peaks at the same time, and you actually have an application that's able to use all the resources of the data center, I've never seen one, but just say it happened, then you need some way to shed load in a hurry. And the way that that's done, I argue you need to have that anyway, because there's always going to be some load your service will see driven by real customers that is beyond which you've provisioned for. It's going to happen. And so you need some way to shed load anyway. So if you have that, then you can start to sell more than there is, and the net is you can get much closer to using all the power that's actually deployed. Super interesting technique. I'm going to come back to it, because the technique can be applied across a variety of dimensions. You can keep applying the same idea. And so I'll come back to it. Power distribution efficiency summary. Well, the first thing I got to tell you is I haven't told you the whole truth yet. I gave you the whole power distribution with all the conversions, and in fact, they're not all there, because we didn't show you yet what was in the server. So there's two more conversions coming up. There's the one everyone knows about that's in the power supply, the PSU. And because everybody knows about it, they're pretty efficient these days. And so to get a 90% supply is quite possible. A lot of people ask for them, and they're fairly common. The next one, there's a voltage regulator down or a voltage regulator module, VRD or VRM, that's in there somewhere. So if you look at the CPU or memory, they run off the 12-volt rail of the supply, if it's a multi-voltage supply, or if it's a single voltage supply, they run on 12 volts. That 12 volts gets delivered somewhere close to the CPU or memory, really close to it, in which case it goes through a VRD and gets stepped down to 1.2, 1.8, depending upon the semiconductor technology you're using. That conversion is not well known. Because it's not well known, vendors save $3 or $4 on each VRD, not very much, and they end up being 80% efficient or worse. And so this is an opportunity where we can get a lot more efficiency easy. And one of the reasons why I'm a big believer in TPUE is it includes that VRD. And because it includes it, we see the inefficiencies of it. And anytime you shine a light on a problem, it's amazing how fast it goes away. All it takes is people just knowing it's there. So I'd like to see us use TPUE because it forces us to inventory everything. And once we inventory everything, we start to get uncomfortable about some of the outcomes. Okay, so what can we do to optimize power consumption? Well, the first one is overselling the power. I'm a huge believer in that. I think it's a wonderful technique. And anything that gathers data and runs optimization program, optimization against it is a wonderful thing. And so setting the goal to get closer and closer to consuming all of the power that you have is a great place to be. So the first one's oversell it. Second one is minimize the number of conversions. No matter how good they are, they're always going to be less than 100%, so just don't convert as frequently. I'm working on designs that have two less conversions in them. It's not that hard to do. It looks very doable. Third one is, well, if you have to do a conversion and you haven't found a way out of it, then do very good conversions. Fourth one, bring high voltage as close to the load as you possibly can, because for a given size conductor, there's a bound on how much copper there is in the world, and so you really won't use an infinitely large conductor. There will be some bound on it. Whatever it is, your higher voltage you run, the more efficient it's going to be. And so bringing 480 all the way to the rack is a clear win, and one that I'm a pretty big fan of. Fifth one, size the voltage regulators to match the load. What vendors do is they put VRDs in for 16 dims or some large number of dims. If you happen to run with one dim, then you're running way low on the VRD's efficiency curve. And typically what happens is they're not flat. And so if this is 100% load, they're pretty good. And as you draw, usually they get a little better and they fall off. And so if you're running a very low load, you could be down around 30% efficiency or even worse. So making sure that you buy servers that are less, that are narrower and are exactly what you targeted to your workload level or the type of equipment you're running is a big efficiency gain. Final one is there's a small gain that can be had in direct current at high voltage delivered directly to the rack. I'm less interested in this because I can't find very big gains, but there's some to be found. It's a few percent, maybe 1 or 2%. It's slightly interesting, but there's regulatory issues with it, and I'm not personally as excited as some. Okay, so that's power distribution. We got that covered. Let's look at the mechanical side now. On the mechanical side, this is what a modern data center looks like. Unfortunately, this is also what a data center looked like 15 years ago. It's also what a data center looked like 20 years ago. There haven't been a lot of changes, and it's a mess. It is a mess. So I'll give you a quick review of what's going on here, and then we'll talk about what we can do to fix it. First thing is, we've got cold air in the far left side of the screen coming up through the floor, up into the cold aisle. It gets pulled by fans in the server, through the server, gets to the hot aisle, rises up towards the ceiling, where it gets pulled back to the computer room air handler or computer room air conditioner, crack or craw, where it is cooled with a water-to-air intercooler, a heat exchanger, big fans running in the craw unit, pushing it down below the floor, and pushing it another 50 feet back out to the servers. So the reason why this is bad is the 50 feet is a bad thing. Moving air is expensive. Air is a terribly expensive fluid to move around. So that's one problem. Distance is their problem. Second one is the space under the floor is often as small as 18 inches. You really want to see several feet. And so the oftentimes cable bound, and so it's high resistance. That's reduces the efficiency greatly. The servers aren't properly enclosed, and so lots of the air leaks over the top or leaks around the side. And what that means is two things wrong with that. You spent first to drive the air all the way down to the rack, and then pulled it all the way back again, and you didn't use it to cool. That's the first thing wrong with it, so that's lost efficiency. The second thing is you diluted the hot air, which means the delta temperature across the crack is less. And it turns out the bigger the delta temperature, the more efficient it's going to actually run. And so that's a second loss you've gotten that. So that's just basically bad design. It shouldn't be happening. Once it gets into the water circuit, we've now taken cold water and we've made it a little bit warmer. We bring it up to the primary loop. Everything above that vertical line is exactly what you'll find in most buildings. This building is using exactly that same design, and it hasn't changed in 30 years. So we've got slightly warmer water in the primary loop. It's passing through a heat exchanger. The heat exchanger is transferring the heat through another conversion over to the condensate loop. The condensate loop's taking it out to the cooling tower. The cooling tower's cooling it. It's bringing it back again. That's actually an optimization that's required in most states, including California. All buildings have to have it. That optimization is called a waterside economizer. If it's too warm outside, that won't work, and so you have to run the air conditioning system, in which case, instead of using the heat exchanger, they'll still use it a bit, the air conditioning evaporator will convert from the temperature in water to the gaseous form, and then it's cooled off in the condenser where we have another conversion back into the water. So we've got two paths through there, one through the heat exchanger, one through the AC system and the chillers. So what do we get out of this? Well, first of all, if you count conversions, you'll find a lot. If you count pumps, you'll find a lot. If you count impellers, you'll find a lot. And these pumps are substantial. These, you know, it's not uncommon to see 100 horsepower electric pumps in these systems, 8 to 12 inch pipes. These are substantial systems. That system, using my standard data center, my 15 megawatt facility, that system on the board, not including the servers, is worth somewhere between $24 and $28 million. This is a lot of money. So we know it's inefficient, and we know it's expensive. Let's figure out what we can do about it. First thing you can do, we talked about the heat leaking around the servers and heat leaking over the top. Well, first thing is don't do that. I mean, honestly, that is the worst design on the planet. It disappoints me deeply that we're mostly still building data centers that way. So there's three designs that enclose it. One is building hot aisle, building walls between hot aisles and cold aisles so that they can't get leakage between them. The only way to pass through the server. That's an Intel facility at Jones Farm, nice design. There's another one with chimneys off the back. Anything going up into race into a drop ceiling, anything that compartmentalizes hot air and cold air and makes the only path between them through the servers is a nice design. And that's probably one of the biggest impacts you can make on TPUE that's possible. It's huge, and it's also dirt cheap. There's a few things you have to worry about with respect to fire control to make sure that the sprinkler systems work well with the wall design. There's little OSHA issues you've got to make sure that just thought through carefully. But generally, 100% easy to do, and the gain is phenomenal. Second one of my sensitive topics, it's the industry is really talking about power. The next thing that we're eventually going to catch on to is we're going to talk about water. Water is a huge issue. Taking my 15 megawatt facility, using standard quality water, it's not highly mineral, it's very average water, putting it out in the desert, it's burning, dissipating 360,000 gallons of water a day. 360,000 gallons a day lost to that tower. It's a picture of a tower there. Think about that. That's a lot of water. That just seems wrong that our industry is consuming that much, and I'll show you there are ways to stop it. 360,000 gallons a day, there's lots worse. And the way it's getting dissipated is two ways. One is, and it's of course, it's the whole principle is evaporation, so a lot of it's lost to evaporation. Unfortunately, when you evaporate water, you end up with mineral content left behind, and that's called blowdown. And so depending upon the mineral content in your water, the blowdown frequency may go up or may go down. The problem with blowdown water is it needs special treatment. So in Quincy, Washington, where Microsoft, I think Yahoo as well, have big facilities, there's a $9 million treatment plant being put in to handle blowdown water. It's just not the best place to be. So this is something I'd just like to get rid of. I think it's a good idea to stop doing this. Okay. Some observations. Who chose the temperature that runs in a data center? So I went to the American Society of Heating and Refrigeration and Air Conditioning Engineers, ASHRAE, and say, well, that's who sets the standards. That's what warranties are driven on. That's where it comes. So what do we learn from them? Well, this is a psychometric chart. This axis is humidity. This axis is temperature. If you hold humidity narrow, it costs you money. If you hold temperature narrow, it costs you money. So the bigger the red circle that's allowed, the cheaper. That's broadly what it's. I'm mostly going to focus on temperature, so I'll focus on the right-hand side of the screen. So the ASHRAE recommendation is 81 degrees Fahrenheit. The ASHRAE allowable is 90 Fahrenheit. So the first thing that's going on is, why would they have a recommendation that's different from allowable? And if something's allowable, what's the difference? Well, it's a very scary paragraph that says something about server mortality worded differently that sounds like, oh my God, I'll lose my job. And so what happens? Nobody runs anywhere close to that 81 degrees I showed you earlier. No one runs it. Not no one. There are some. There are some very clear-thinking data center operators that do run near that, but very few. Very, very few. So the first thing we've got going on is we've got nobody's running anywhere near the recommendations from the refrigeration experts. So probably got some room to gain. So I asked Dell, what would you warrant your servers for? When do you, if I bring you servers and say, listen, fix them for free. They said 95 Fahrenheit, which is to say, how much risk am I actually running? If I'm running towards the high side of that, and my server manufacturer says, fine, we'll fix them for free if they fail early. They're very confident they're not going to fail early. They don't. When you're talking about 50,000 servers, you do not want a mistake. This is a very big mistake if you get a warranty problem. And so it's just they're confident. I asked Rackable, in fact, some joint design work we did on CloudRack, 104 Fahrenheit is what they'll warrant. 104 Fahrenheit, phenomenally high number. This is a telco number. NEBS is a standard used by the telco industry. Phenomenal number. So this says we could go higher. There's just no question. Absolutely no question. Let's see how much higher we can go. So what I did here is I said, well, whenever you're trying to find out what limits are, you probe the extreme. What's the hottest day the world has ever experienced and been recorded? And that was 1922 in Libya. It was 136 degrees Fahrenheit. That was a hot day. Interesting. If you look at the spec temperatures of every component that fits in a server, every one of them is spec'd at a higher temperature than that worst day in Libya in 1922. Which is to say, technically, you could take 1922 Libyan air and cool any server component with no air conditioning. It's technically possible. Now, admittedly, it's not cost effective because it would take a hurricane of that hot air in order to cool it. It would take a phenomenal mechanical design to find a way to do it, but it's technically possible. So what that proves to us, previous charts prove that we should go higher. What this chart proves is we can go higher. We need now it's engineering. Is if I have to move a hurricane worth of air, I spend a lot of power. That's dumb. If I keep it really cold, I don't have to move a lot of air, but I spend a lot on cooling, and that's dumb. So we can now do an engineering optimization. This says that it's possible, okay? Well, what can we do? One of the things that we can do is to say, listen, we're going to do what's called air-side economization, which is the mechanicals folks saying open the window, basically. That's all it says. Right now, we've got a closed loop inside a data center. We heat the air, we cool the air, we heat the air, we cool the air. And here we're saying, hey, I got an idea. Let's take air from outside, run it through the servers, and then dump it back outside. Okay, well, if it's really hot outside, you might want to cool it a bit. Say, well, geez, it's $28 million to put air conditioning on there. Could I avoid it? And the answer is we don't know. Maybe. The trick is, here's the balance. To avoid the $28 million worth of air conditioning equipment, and actually you can go with less, I'll tell you why. To avoid that, if we raise the temperature in the data center and it's not super hot outside, we're golden. We actually don't need that equipment. So for this climate, don't need it. Absolutely could run with no process-based cooling, no AC system at all, no chiller. So that's interesting. If you put an evaporative cooler on it, this is a picture of a college football game. You'll see it most NFL teams when it's hot. Big fans, misters, very common. What happens is the taking water through a state change cools the air. It's quite effective. It's referred to as a swamp cooler. It's evaporative cooling. So if you're willing to employ outside air with evaporative cooling, you can get but basically what we're after is raise the server room temperature as high as you're confident will work, and then say, well, what climates can I operate in without air conditioner? With evaporative cooling, we're opening up more climates. So this will work in Phoenix. Now, it won't work in Singapore, because the air is already too wet. So at Singapore, we either have to run with air conditioning systems parts of the day, not every day, but we have to run with it, or we have to run a little bit more server temperature yet again. So we got to figure out where the balance point is, what the right answer is. The trick is, if you're very, very rarely using air conditioning, the bad news is you're still buying it. We hate that. But the good news is it's only burning power when you're using it. And so this is a game that plays no matter where we are. People have concerns with this. And what you'll find is the industry says, oh, that won't work because of X. And the truth is, I feel bad. Show me the data. And no one has any data on any of these things. So the same thing's true here. I know of facilities that did exactly this. They're beautiful facilities, and they have full air conditioning that they never intend to use. Why did they spend money on air conditioning? Well, here's the problem. If I start up those diesel engines, say I have a power failure, the particulate matter off 11 diesel engines burning 180 gallons of diesel an hour is non-zero. And so they're worried those particulates will destroy my servers. Well, they will, maybe, or maybe not. We don't know. The truth is, nobody knows. If there's a forest fire nearby, then that'll destroy my servers. And so they have to have the provision to stop using outside air and go to the air conditioning system. I'm suggesting, people costs aren't as high as we think. It doesn't take that many people to have an air filter change once a week. Let's play with filters. So this needs work, because it isn't proven, but I claim the converse isn't proven either. In other words, this isn't proven to work, I'll bet on it, but folks that say it won't work don't have any data. Okay, what do we got? We've got some possibilities for optimizations here. These possibilities are first, tight control of airflow, weight optimization. Second one is raising the data center temperatures, big gain. Cooling towers rather than air conditioning, and then finally, trying to get rid of the cooling towers and save the water as well as a final step. Any of these things make sense, and they all have possible impact. I'm going to go to one more slide. I'm going to show you resource consumption shaping. Resource consumption shaping is it's the generalization of what I showed you earlier of power yield management. What resource consumption shaping is observing is you have to provision at peak. Remember we were provisioning power? We had to have enough power for the worst day. Well, turns out that applies to every dimension. You have to have enough servers for the worst day. You have to have enough disk I/O capacity for the worst day. You have to have enough networking capacity for the worst day. So this gets super interesting. Let's look at networking. Networking commonly bills at the 95th percentile, which is to say, if you push the peak up, it costs real money. But the interesting thing is, what if I add networking in the trough? How much does that cost? It's nothing. That's interesting. That says there's two opportunities here. The first opportunity is, if I could find some way to take some of what's driving my peak and push the peak off and put it into trough, I'm dropping the cost down dramatically. That's saving real money right now. And I guarantee you, wherever you work, there's traffic that's mission critical that must be served right now, and there's other traffic that can be done 300 milliseconds from now, or 700 milliseconds from now, or a minute from now. It just doesn't matter. And if you learn to separate those two, you can push the peak off and start filling valleys. That saves real money. The second thing is, once you see that the valley is free, then you have opportunities to do interesting things with it. For example, some of the ideas that I have on data replication, where you have multiple data centers and I'm synchronously replicating to a bunch of different data centers. I believe in that model greatly because I like to pull the redundancy out of the hardware and pull it up high into the software, because the hardware systems are never reliable enough, no matter what they do. I'm always stuck trying to either deal with downtime or having some redundancy in the software stack. So if you pull it up in the stack, then I like to eliminate the redundancy below and save money. So because of that, replicating between data centers is a good thing to do. It's something I want to do. But people say, oh my God, you'll have to send every bit of traffic to every data center. Think of the cost. You know, WAN charges aren't going down. There's no Moore's Law. It's a terrible place to be. It's all, all true. But if you can find a way to do that synchronization traffic in a valley, it's free. Only cost of time. So that's interesting. Final one is, observation from friends that work in the networking world. If you have a very narrow pipe, the utilization level tends to be relatively flat. If you have a mega big pipe, the traffic starts to get more and more spiky. The bigger the pipe, the more spiky it gets. We're getting bigger pipes everywhere, which is to say the utilization level of those pipes for every service I've ever been involved with is actually going down. We wouldn't want to go backwards on having a small pipe because, in fact, you need to have the traffic served when you're peaking. You got to do it. But we're spending a lot of time where we're not moving all the traffic. So these ideas applied to networking actually have a fair amount of legs. It also can be applied to servers. You have to buy enough servers to support the maximum load that you're ever going to run. Well, some traffic is waiting for customers, and some traffic is analysis traffic that you can do 30 seconds from now. And so there's ways of pushing into the valleys, and it applies on all sorts of different dimensions. And the real lesson here is spikiness costs money, and anything you do to flatten the spikes, the closer you get to a flat line, the cheaper it is. And so it just says, ooh, that's interesting. Anything we can do to cut the peaks, fill the valleys is a good place to be. Okay, that's what I had. My basic conclusion is it's not about app performance. It's about the performance and the efficiency of the entire data center. Second thing is it's not about performance. Performance is a unidimensional measurement that has no value whatsoever. It's about work done, performance, per dollar. It's work done per joule. And if you look at that optimization point and just only take those two points home, you will do things differently and your company will gain from it. Final one is help me evangelize TPUE. I think it's the right way to measure things. And my conclusion, there's big opportunities to be gained here and it's worth working on. So thanks very much for your time. I really appreciate it. If there's any questions at all, I'd love to field them.
Hi, James. Rick Farrow. I always wonder why, you know, the big data center users like yourselves don't actually have custom-built servers. I mean, maybe you do, but it seems like you would have a pathway for all the hot components. So you have like the hurricane air going there, but maybe that's everything on the board. I don't, you know, it doesn't seem like it is.
Yeah, very good question. So it's one of the reasons why I work in services is some of these optimizations, if you ask me that when I'm working with customers in the enterprise, the answer is, well, I can't. We don't buy enough servers, not worth it. As soon as the numbers get big, things become possible. So Google does do their own servers, and Microsoft and many of Amazon, many of us, partner really closely with server designers and get built pretty much what we want. Okay. And it's debatable which one's the right way to go. But, you know, for example, Dell has a special group that does nothing but custom design for high-volume buyers. It's the DCS team. You're right. There's huge gains that can be had. And
well, yeah, you're just making me think of the last Dell rack mount server I looked at.
Yes.
And the inefficient fans. It sounds like a hurricane and all the weird path.
Okay. Those are all going away.
Great. Okay, thanks.
Absolutely. What you're going to see is big impellers on the back of the modules and shared power supplies across multiple servers.
I wanted to ask you about your point in the graph that you were just showing. That looked very much like a diurnal sort of time of day graph. It's one thing to, you know, push your traffic by a few milliseconds one way or another, but it's another to push it by 8 hours or something.
Yeah.
So I guess the question is, what's the opportunity there in terms of shaping traffic at scales that people don't start getting upset, or you affect like your consistency model in terms of replication?
Super good question. So rewording, there's some cycles that are very high frequency that are easy to take the peaks into the troughs. There's some that are diurnal, and those ones, the question is, how do we optimize a diurnal cycle? Because in fact, what you were looking at there was the Pacific Ocean and the fact that there's less people during that period. So what do you do there? It's a wonderful thing happening in our industry, and that is, and I've seen this play out 100 times. When anyone automates first, the first thing a company does is they automate their operational workload. They automate selling stuff or trading things or whatever they do, they automate that. And so at first, all services in a company are OLTP systems. They're operational. They're to do with running the business. And what they quickly find is, you know, there's a lot of really good data there. I bet you I can analyze that and try to understand my supply chain better. Or maybe I could get the quality more even. Or maybe I, you know, there's lots you can do with data. And so what's happening is the amount of workloads that are OLTP, which have those time-critical characteristics, like a customer's waiting, you got to do it now, versus the analysis workloads, I'm seeing a skew towards analysis, and that's a wonderful thing because we can optimize those. Because if those are done 4 hours later or 8 hours later, we're fine. Make sense?
Yes, except there are some people who also want the real-time analysis, right?
What you've got to do is, there's no magic. I mean, if you can't knock off a peak because you're monetizing it and you're getting value from it,
that's
then,
okay.
Then that's good.
Yeah. Norman Wilson. If I didn't have a real question, I'd be tempted to ask, where does the power go in high-end Italian cars? But
well, the answer to that, I can't resist answering, is Magneti Marelli, who is produces the ignition equipment for most of them. Unfortunately, oftentimes it doesn't go anywhere. They don't start.
But the real question is, if I'm cooling my servers with 35 degree air, 35 Celsius.
Yep.
From the outside, does it matter what the humidity is of that air?
Great question. So the question there is on humidity. This is another one of the great boogeymen of the industry. If you don't tightly control humidity, the world will end, your wife will leave you, and all your servers will fail. We don't know that that's true. Here's the scary stuff. So at very low humidity levels, static shock's a risk, and you can lose servers that way. And so there's some concern at the very low end. At the very high end, no one's able to articulate with me why it matters. And so at the low end, I'm not convinced it matters because I don't want people in the data center anyway. And if they do go in, I want them properly grounded. But I'll work with them. If you're using evaporative cooling, we can cheaply raise the humidity, and if it's too cold outside, we can recirculate some of the server air to warm it. So we got that covered. I claim the low end, we're golden, we can do that for free. At the high end, I want non-condensing, which is a complicated way of saying, hey, I don't like it raining on my servers. Well, it's not a problem because you're pulling air from the outside. The first thing it does is get warmer, in which case its ability to carry water goes up. And so I claim it's not a problem.
Thank you. Hi, I have two networking questions. First is on the pie chart that you showed of where all the costs go, I didn't actually see networking in there, and yet there's this myth that network bandwidth is expensive. So I'm curious to which bucket that fell in and how much it actually is.
Yeah.
The other question I have is, when you showed the peaks and valleys point and mentioned that network bandwidth is currently charged at 95% from peak, the question I have is, if we do a better job of filling those valleys, is that just going to cause the guys who are selling network bandwidth to change their pricing model?
Okay. So let's start with the first one. Where's the networking in there? Well, because there's this is infrastructure only, so it doesn't include the wide area network costs. I'm not including that. And if you look at networking gear inside the data center, first time I saw a large, I won't repeat the manufacturer's name, I looked at the efficiency of a very large border router. I just went ballistic. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. I'm going to throw them all out. And it turns out they are terribly inefficient. Yeah, exactly. They're terribly inefficient, but there's not very many of them. They're almost invisible in the total power dissipation. And so if you work on the most important problems first, they don't qualify. There's not enough of them. So that's the first one. I happen to believe in replacing those systems with commodity networking. I heard there was I have a friend out there somewhere. But the reason I want to replace it with commodity networking components is because I want to drive costs down and I want more reliable systems. And I know you're working exactly on that kind of thing. So first thing, they barely show. Second one you asked is to do with, if we flatten the workload, I mentioned that the closer we get to flat consumption, won't that take away some of the optimizations that are possible in the provider? Possibly right. The trade-offs are, it's very difficult for them to fully utilize all of their lines, and so they're blending the peaks from different customers and getting some value from that. It's possible that that would change pricing. I haven't worked it out carefully enough to know the answer.
Thanks.
Hi, Dave Fetro. It sounds like with the current densities, air cooling is still good, especially since we could run hotter than we think we can, apparently. But I'm wondering, 5-6 years down the road, if we're going to be whether I just noticed that there was absolutely no mention of water cooling to the racks, water cooling to the servers,
yep.
Evaporative cooling in the server in one oddball case.
Yep.
I'm just wondering if that makes sense now or if you think that might make sense in the future.
Yeah, that's a great question, and unfortunately, it brings me close to one of my pet peeves. The industry loves density. We love to pack more servers in a small space. And the weirdest thing is, if you look at the cost, the floor space cost, you saw a little tiny slice that I didn't bother to account for. The cost of the data center building, the shell, all the land and everything else, is a tiny little slice. When we're optimizing for density, we're optimizing that tiny slice. It's just not thinking clearly. And so if you look at my blog, you'll find the odd rant against blade servers. Not because turning servers on their side and making them smaller is not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just if you pay a premium and all you get is smallness, this is not such a good thing. It makes the mechanical problem, the cooling problem, more difficult. So my first question is, are we sure that density is a good idea? And if it is such a good idea, how come the really big service providers like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Baidu, why aren't they running blades? That's an interesting question. So I'll leave it as a question rather than an answer. But I think we're overestimating density's value is the first part of that. The second part, are there advantages to density? There are. Extremely low latency communications and high performance computing systems doesn't like long distances. So there are some upsides to density. It's not evil. It just you have to have the density should be driven by cost and value rather than because someone decide to come up with it. So within my vision of how far I can see, I don't see air failing us for 5 years. It looks like we're good for 5 years, and I strongly suspect this is going to be like CMOS, where we thought for years CMOS was dead, we got to go to gallium arsenide, and the truth is, if there's enough people doing something, enough R&D gets spent on it, it just works. And so I suspect we'll see some of that.
Hi there, Dan Klein. You said shedding light on a problem is
yes.
The key to getting something done. And about 20 years ago, I wrote what I thought was a pretty compelling paper on RISC versus CISC, saying that 85% of the Pentium is not used by compilers.
Yeah.
Today the preponderant architecture.
Yeah.
I didn't shed the light in the right place, but how can we shed the light on the right people in your problem?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I was somewhat more naive myself back then, so I remember predicting that Intel was dead in 82 because, looking at the Z8000, the 68K, those were better processors. And then the RISC systems came along, and I was in love with them. They're just wonderful, and they're all dead now. What happens in our industry is not fair, and that is...
Or right,
correct. But it's a beautiful thing, is we don't necessarily always get the right architecture, and I think we both feel like we didn't get the right one there necessarily, but we do get the right things happening. And so if you look at the cost of computing, the right thing happened. We could have done more with a different architecture, but the right thing happened. And so I claim the right thing is going to happen. All you need to do is to make this a focus item that says, listen, I care about the power that's dissipated in this way, and we'll get an optimization on that. The folks that are most capable of doing the best optimization are the ones with the biggest R&D budgets, and they're the ones with the most critical mass behind them. And so it won't necessarily give you a better architecture, but it will find a solution.
Samuel Schubert, DPFL. So you briefly talked in the beginning about servers, programs, algorithms, possibly, that they're inefficient. Do you have maybe some examples on that?
Yeah, sure. There's a couple things are going on there. One is, I guess, three things that are worth mentioning. One is servers are seldom fully utilized. And so you have fallow resources that aren't fully being used. That's the first inefficiency. Second inefficiency is software systems are never as efficient as they could be. And this one I'm a little bit of two minds on, because developer productivity drives innovation, and so higher level languages that tend to be somewhat less efficient, I think, are a good thing, but we do give up some efficiency when we're doing that. And we should never confuse increased productivity with just bad software. There's an awful lot of bad software out there. No one got more productive because they were doing that, just bad software. So there's a lot of that out there. Third possibility is the software running on a given server seldom uses all the resources of a server. So even if it's incredibly good software running at very high utilization, you still will find that it's I/O bound, or it's memory subsystem bound. It's going to be bound on something, which is to say the rest of the resources in the server aren't fully utilized. And so those three areas and understanding them gives me ideas, and I think gives all of us ideas on how we can optimize differently. For example, on that last one, the thing I'm talking to Intel and AMD about and I'm really excited by is the ability to shut off components of a server, to take some of the cores offline. If you can't use them for this particular workload, then stop running them.
So I understand TPUE, and that looks like a good thing.
Excellent.
How does that take into account, like, the performance of the systems themselves? Like, so yeah. Sun has been propagating that measurement, you know, where you actually include performance as part of your calculation. How does that calculate into TPUE?
It's a great question. Here's the challenge. Everybody wants to measure, and it's the right thing to measure, useful work done to power consumption and useful work done to dollars. And that's what I'm telling you should be optimizing for. And TPUE doesn't do all of that. And so why is it a good idea? Here's the challenge. If you want to compare across different industries, an HPC workload compared against a commercial workload, there's no metric of work done that applies to both those workloads. It's just very different worlds. And as a consequence, you could spend forever having debates on the quality of benchmarks and whether a benchmark's right or not. So what I'm doing with TPUE is I'm saying, listen, we're going to factor off the computational elements in the disk. We're not going to look at those. And we just look at all the rest of the infrastructure, because that we can actually compare and line up. Now, when you've got the remaining components, which I care about deeply as well, that's the efficiency of the computational element and the software stack. On that one, I don't have a way of comparing across all industries. And so what I recommend is choose a benchmark that's right in your industry. And you know, on the infrastructure, we can use TPUE to compare against everyone else. Within an industry, the software stack and the computational elements, that I think you have to compare within your own industry and with workloads that look like yours. Alex.